Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Our legal roundtable panel is with us today to discuss legal issues and potential legal issues that have found their way into the news headlines, and there are plenty of them. Missouri has a new abortion law that seems destined to go to court. Yet another Ferguson-related lawsuit gets a legal green light. And the St. Louis Circuit Attorney is going to court so she can go to court. Also, the Attorney General of the United States must still be wondering if he is coming or going. And joining me in studio are attorneys Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor at Washington University. Bill Freivogel is Professor of Journalism at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. And Susan Appleton teaches law at Washington University School of Law. And she is back with us once again. Good to have you back with us, Susan.
Thank you, Don.
Let me begin with you. I'll point out before we begin this part of the conversation that you are a member of the board of Planned Parenthood. And one of the reasons we wanted to have you here today because you're so active in legal affairs. And it seems pretty certain that the new abortion law signed by Governor Greitens a couple of days ago is going to be challenged in court. Will it?
I can't predict that, but I think there are a number of bases on which this law is vulnerable. Do you want me to talk about the different provisions?
Love for you to do so.
So, first of all, this new law requires that the state-mandated script for informed consent, which has to be given 72 hours before the abortion is performed, that that script has to be delivered by the physician performing the abortion or by the referring physician. There are certain new tests required for pathology reports following abortions, mandated annual unannounced inspections of facilities providing abortions, requirements that the State Department of Health and Senior Services approve plans to respond to complications from medication abortions, a grant of concurrent authority to the Missouri Attorney General to prosecute violations of the law concurrent with that of local prosecutors, and then a ban on regulation of so-called pregnancy resource centers or crisis pregnancy centers. So all of those are in the bill. According to the U.S. Supreme Court, the standard that applies when an abortion restriction is challenged is the undue burden standard, whether or not the restriction imposes an undue burden on access to women who are choosing abortion. The Supreme Court clarified what an undue burden is just last year in the Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt case and explained that the question is not just how burdensome is the law in the abstract, but what countervailing benefits justify these restrictions. And I think that's where some of these provisions will run into problems because they do burden access without demonstrable health benefits, notwithstanding the fact that the legislators claimed that there was a health rationale for all of these.
In other words, it's causing women to have to jump through too many hoops in order to
without sufficient justifications rooted in health. So I think most vulnerable would be the 72-hour wait and the requirement that the physician providing the abortion or the referring physician deliver that state-mandated script, and I think some of the pathology testing requirements, which also create burdens, and it hasn't been shown that there are any health benefits arising from any of these.
It would seem to me, the layman looking at that and what you've just said, that the Supreme Court standard is fairly clear and that this is contrary to that.
I would say so. I would say so. But I think this is an effort to push the envelope and see exactly what the outer limits of the applicable test are. And it's expensive to taxpayers. There was just a case decided by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit maybe a week ago involving different abortion restrictions in which the taxpayers now have to foot $150,000 attorney's fees for Planned Parenthood because it was clear that that Planned Parenthood won that particular case.
Mark, you're nodding in affirmation, I think.
I think in many ways this is a political act by Greitens, bringing people back for a special session where there's a good chance that at least a big chunk of this could be overturned by the courts. Having said that, the Supreme Court is still very much up in play, and Who knows what, you know, by the time this would get to a Supreme Court, if it even would, that could be a couple years down the line. Who knows what the lineup might look like? So I think, I mean, it's part of the strategy you've seen around the nation where just push the limits to see what can happen and hope that the Supreme Court changes. I think every time you have a big Supreme Court decision like the women's health in Texas, everyone kind of holds their breath to think, is this going to be the time maybe things get undone?
And that was decided by an 8-justice court. Now, we now have a new justice, Neil Gorsuch, but that really wouldn't change the balance there. It would only be if there are additional changes in court personnel.
Bill Freivogel, pro-life advocates, it seems to me, are really eager to have this brought before the Supreme Court. They want another ruling on abortion.
Well, yeah, they do. I mean, their hope is that they will be able to read Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which affirmed the basic constitutional protection of the abortion right. Read that out of the Constitution. There's five, you know, as I think Mark said, there's five votes that still support that there's a right, a constitutional right to an abortion. And I mean, if you looked at it over the last 30 years, you know, the 30 years that Susan and I have been actually talking about these issues, back to Webster versus Reproductive mm-hmm. Health, which was a 1980s Missouri case. Mm-hmm. If you looked at it, I mean, what has happened is that the abortion rights folks have been successful in keeping the constitutional guarantee, and the anti-abortion folks have been incredibly successful at getting all sorts of laws passed, many of them unconstitutional, but which have had the overall practical impact of getting a lot of clinics closed so that you have way fewer. And even though in Texas the abortion rights people won, already there were fewer mm-hmm. clinics. In Missouri, I think there's just one at this point. There's a hope to expand on abortion rights advocates' position to expand to some of the other parts of the state, but right now St. Louis.
You're talking about Missouri now.
In Missouri, yeah, only Texas. St. Louis right. has an operating abortion clinic. Is that right?
Yes.
So they've been very successful from that point of view.
This is jumping ahead of the current situation, but if a law such as the Missouri law were to go before the Supreme Court, could it, on the basis of what is being would be challenged, could that cause the undoing of Roe v. Wade? In and of itself.
I think there could be that argument made. None of the particular provisions in this statute, though, necessarily attack that core right.
Yeah, that's why I ask.
But we've seen justices in cases that also concerned more limited provisions come out and say that because they don't recognize the underlying right, that of course all of these restrictions are valid. So it could go that far. I think the arguments would have to be made in the right way.
I mean, you'd need, like you said, you'd probably need some changes of justices, but that's kind of what happened in Citizens United. It was originally a very limited question, and then it became a much bigger question. Mm-hmm. And because of, not because of either party suggested it, but because the justices decided it.
So I have a couple other observations. I mean, we know that the majority of the Missouri legislature is anti-abortion, and we know that the governor mm-hmm. is as well. But I would like to take them seriously about their stated concern for women's health. And it would be great if somehow people who are concerned about women's health could get together and find some sort of common ground. So, for example, NPR has been doing a series about the untold stories of the risk of maternal mortality and childbirth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think if we could have, say, birth control more accessible, if we could have some legal measures supporting that, we would have fewer women faced with unplanned pregnancies who are seeking abortion, and we'd have fewer people who are risking death in childbirth from an unwanted pregnancy. I think it's very telling that the state-mandated script for informed consent only talks about the dangers of abortion, doesn't communicate anything about the risks of childbirth. And second, that the law that says there can be no interference with what crisis pregnancy centers might do that crisis pregnancy centers don't have to communicate, or they're not required to be medically accurate in the information that they give. So it is a very skewed picture, which represents, I think, the values of the majority of the Missouri legislature.
There's one other element to this legislation that I'm not totally clear on, and that is that it exempts the city from anti-discrimination laws somehow, that women who have had abortions can be discriminated against? Is that the way we read that?
Well, I think that's part and parcel of the desire to protect crisis pregnancy centers, as I read it, because they didn't want to have to hire women.
I think that's right. I think that the author of the bill thought that there have been some press reports that overstated what that provision did, and it was he maintains that it was only to protect the pregnancy crisis centers, which are trying to avoid abortions. And I just want to sort of second what Susan says, is that there's this real disconnect between the statements of Missouri legislators and legislators all across the country that they're trying to look out for the health of women in abortion clinics, when in fact they're just trying to close abortion clinics. Mm-hmm. That's the fact.
All right. Anything else to add to that? Should we just move on? We're already very close to our first break. Let me bring in this next subject here for a quick discussion. We've talked about this before, and that's the young fifth grader, a former city resident who now lives in St. Louis County and is going to school there, but really wants to return to his school in the city. But he is not being allowed to do so. The courts have just ruled against that attempt. What's going on there, Bill?
Well, basically, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals said that he and his mom, with the help of, I guess, the Pacific Legal Foundation, had sued the wrong group. They had sued the Voluntary Interdistrict Coordinating Council. Is it still called Council?
Choice Corporation.
Choice Corporation.
Yeah.
I'm given the old title. Yeah. And they had sued them, claiming that it was their rules that kept the student from being able to go to the charter school of the choice, but it's actually the school that had done that. So they sued the wrong person. The court said that meant that they did not have standing.
So is it a dead issue, or does it come back in a different
form? No, I think it could come. Yeah, I think lack of standing is almost a misnomer, although that is what the court said. I think these plaintiffs could have standing if they picked the right defendants, and mm-hmm. the Voluntary Interdistrict Choice Corporation is the wrong defendant. It should have been the school. So I think the case could be brought again. And I think then if a court got to the merits, it would look at some of the Supreme Court precedents on use of race in admissions.
And that the Ronnie White, who was the district court judge in this case, actually did look at some of the merits in addition to making this standing ruling. And he made very clear that the 1999 agreement to settle the desegregation case was settled law in this the law of the case, and would determine. Would govern, and that you couldn't really challenge that under using the Equal Protection Clause. So he actually got to some of the merits. The Court of Appeals didn't deal with that. But if they sue the right person, if they sue the school, and it goes back to Ronnie White, one would expect that to happen again.
Right. Well, let's leave it at that and take our break, come back and talk about some other things. This is a Legal Roundtable panel discussion with Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Susan Appleton. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to the Legal Roundtable panel. Before we continue the discussion, let's bring in Bob calling from Millstadt, Illinois. He wants to reference, I think, earlier discussion. So go ahead, Bob. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is more a general one. I'm seeing intense involvement of religion in the government, your discussion on abortion laws. They just appointed Sam Brownback as ambassador at large for religion, I believe it was. We have an Office of Faith-Based Initiative in the White House. We have vouchers for private and parochial schools, the teaching of evolution versus creationism in science, the case that was just settled about tires and the government funding tires on the playground of a church school. It just seems like there's a big push, and I'm wondering, is there anything at all in the Constitution that prohibits the government from funding religion or vice versa?
Thank you for the call.
Well, the answer to that is, you're correct that there's a lot of religious issues that are in public life. But the answer to your last question is, yes, there's a part of the First Amendment. It's called the Establishment Clause, which says that the government cannot establish a religion. And that means that there's got to be some separation of church and state. So the government can't directly fund church activities. And, the case you referred to involving the playground equipment, which was Trinity Lutheran Daycare Center in Columbia, Missouri, the court in saying that they couldn't be discriminated against as far as getting the secondhand rubber to build their playground. The court said, we're limiting this to playground materials. We're not saying it involves anything sort of more religious than keeping kids from skinning their knees. But a lot of this is, looking ahead, the biggest cases of the next Supreme Court term involve the question of whether or not bakers and florists and small town newspapers can refuse to serve same-sex couples, refuse to bake them a cake, give them some flowers for their wedding ceremony, or publish their wedding, their announcement. I mean, it's actually that latter case is actually not before the Supreme Court, but probably will get there. And Neil Gorsuch, the new justice, is extremely strong on religious freedom, the other part of the religious protection in the First Amendment.
Yeah, so I would say that's where the tension is. There's not only an establishment clause that prohibits government establishment of religion, but there's a free exercise clause, and there's a very fine line to walk about in keeping the state or federal government out of religion. To what extent does that somehow penalize religious schools or other religious groups or individuals who are exercising their religion? And I think that working out that delicate balance is what we're seeing in the courts. Yeah.
But nowhere in the Constitution is separation of church and state actually mentioned.
No. I mean, it's the Establishment Clause.
It says that the government cannot establish a religion, and that has been interpreted to mean there has to be a separation of church and state. Yeah. Initially, some people said that meant a wall between church and state. Thomas Jefferson used that phrase. More conservative justices say, well, it's not really supposed to be a wall. There can be religion in the public sphere, so it's one of the very most fundamental things our country's about, protecting religion, religious observance, but not forcing religious views down people's throats.
And there's a real tension, like we said. And I think it's worth repeating that Trinity Lutheran case, they say, it's limited to this fact pattern, which is very limited. But I think they're going to be more comfortable having the government provide support as long as you're not favoring one religion over another. I think that's coming down the line, and where that'll go. The one with the bakers and stuff, I mean, think about it, though, if, somebody was refusing to serve African-Americans based on their religion, would the, how would the court feel about that? And so I think there's a better chance of that one getting not getting anywhere, but what do I know?
And I should say, in addition to the constitutional provisions, some of these cases come up under a federal statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was enacted pursuant to the First Amendment, and there's some state counterparts to those laws as well.
While we're on the subject of basically national issues, if you will, and constitutional issues, we can't get very far in a discussion these days about legal issues without what's going on in Washington now. I cite Jeff Sessions and the situation he finds himself in with regard to his recusal, the fact that the president apparently wants to force him out so that he can get somebody else in there, perhaps to fire Bob Mueller, and his investigation. We've got the issue of presidential pardons, which is all around this. I read this morning at Politico, I think it was, that not only could the president pardon himself, but he could do it via Twitter, which is probably the way he'd do it anyway. But that would be an acceptable means of doing that. Where do we start on something like this? Does anyone want to start to peel the onion?
One, you've raised a couple of issues. One issue is, you know, the president seems to think that Sessions, as attorney general, is the president's lawyer. And he's the lawyer for the people of the United States, for our government. Now, you know, Trump, President Trump is the head of that government, so he probably gets some more deference on interpretation of the law, just like the president of a corporation would have some more influence. But he's not Trump's lawyer, and he seems to misunderstand that. And so there's been a, I think this idea that Sessions just should do whatever the president says. I mean, we had those same issues. We've had those issues coming up throughout time. I mean, that was something that was going on with the Bush White House, with the torture memos and stuff. How are you supposed to be doing what the president says, or the president's proxies, or are you supposed to be doing what the law says? So, I mean, so far, Sessions has been, I mean, this recusing yourself, or there's an appearance that I think most lawyers would say that's a good thing, mm-hmm. and would agree with what he
said. Oddly enough, most Democrats.
Yeah, exactly. Trump's done a great job of getting the Democrats to back Sessions.
Yes, I was going to say one-time opponents of Sessions are now rallying to his support. And I do think that his recusal, there's widespread agreement that that was the only appropriate course of action.
Yeah, I think the only person who disagrees with that is Donald Trump, and I haven't seen his law degree. he clearly had to recuse himself. This is, I mean, after this extraordinary week, this is a most extraordinary thing for the president to be bashing his attorney general, his first supporter from the Senate. I mean, Sessions has done a lot of things that Trump likes, you know, on immigration, sanctuary cities, saying he's just going to support the cops, enforce drug laws, be tougher in sentencing, all things which, you know, liberals hate. But as far as on the pardon question, it's a debated question whether the president can pardon himself or during Watergate, the Office of Legal Counsel and the Justice Department said no, a president cannot pardon himself. I mean, the word pardon sort of means you pardon somebody else.
Mm-hmm. And it's an admission of guilt also.
he could pardon his son and son-in-law. But if he did that too soon, then his son and son-in-law couldn't assert the Fifth Amendment. So that could actually end up backfiring. What I don't know is whether he can get away with – I sort of don't think so – whether he can get away with saying, oh, Sessions, you're so great on Homeland Security. Now that Kelly's taken over as chief of staff, we're going to send you over to Homeland Security. And now I'm going to pardon a new attorney general. And, oh, look, he doesn't have to be recused from the Russia investigation. And now this new attorney general can say – I'm not recused. I'm getting rid of Mueller. He's done this, that, and the other thing. I think he'll run into a lot of problems because of the enormous respect that Mueller has on both sides of the aisle. I mean, he's a Republican himself, just as Comey was.
This may seem like a very basic question, but when we talk about this story, we keep hearing the term, it could lead to a constitutional crisis. Okay, so what is the constitutional crisis here?
Well, it'd be it's a constitutional crisis. It's already, isn't it? A little bit of a constitutional crisis when you have you have shown that the president's campaign met with a Russian lawyer to receive Vladimir Putin's dirt on Hillary Clinton. That sounds like collusion to me, regardless of what they call it. And then you also have all of this evidence of possible obstruction of justice by the president himself. I mean, the White House keeps saying, we're not being investigated for obstruction of justice. I'll bet. I mean, no one's told them they're not being investigated for obstruction of justice. No. Clearly, Mueller is investigating him for obstruction of justice for, you know, having tried to get Mueller to drop the Flynn investigation, demanded loyalty from I mean, having tried to get Comey to drop the Flynn investigation, and then having fired Comey for not giving his allegiance and for not dropping the Flynn investigation. So I think he clearly faces a possible obstruction of justice investigation. And that then raises the constitutional question, can the president be indicted?
Yeah, so I think the constitutional crisis relates to our system of separation of powers and exactly what the extent of authority of each branch of government is and to what extent Congress can trump the president's, excuse the pun there, but stop him from wielding unlimited authority in this matter and cutting off this particular investigation. Then, of course, I think at some point the courts would have the final
Right. So it would come out, and then our system depends on people doing what the courts say, and the courts have no power. I mean, Congress has got the power of the purse. They can cut you off that way, and the president's got the army. Courts just have those snazzy-looking robes. That's it.
So that's the crisis when it has to go before the courts, right. And the courts and have to make a determination as to—
Or the courts have to enforce their determination, yeah. I think, is what Mark
yeah.
is saying.
And I think, you know, Bill was saying we do have this memo from the Nixon era where they said the president couldn't pardon him or herself, but— That doesn't mean Trump couldn't do it. He could do it, and then it would go to the courts. And it would be, like many legal questions, up to what the court says the law is to determine what the law is. Another interesting, I think, aspect is if you do a pardon, like what Bill said, you know, you all of a sudden lose that right to self-incrimination. But there could be states might be able to bring actions for some crimes, because I don't think you can – I think the pardon would work for federal stuff.
And I would agree with Bill's analysis of the facts, but I think part of the reason we're in crisis mode right now is that there isn't a shared understanding of facts. There are members of the public who completely dismiss any allegations of collusion or think that if there was wrongdoing in a campaign, it must have been by Hillary Clinton. So, and I think that those are very firmly held beliefs.
And this kind of situation doesn't come up. So we're in uncharted ground. I mean, you had the Nixon stuff, and you had a little bit with Bill Clinton when whether he could be indicted while he was still president. But yeah, this doesn't, as everyone knows, this doesn't happen most times.
But maybe the Pentagon Papers case was, exemplified this sort of problem.
And the Nixon tapes
yes.
yeah. case was a similar situation. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, Nixon listened to the
Supreme Court
about having
it, right.
to turn them. I mean, Susan, you're being very generous to the Trump supporters. I think I would normally like to be so kind. But, you know, a person has got to have their views rest upon some facts.
And the
views about the Russia interference being fake news does not seem to rely on anything other than the president's assertion.
Yes, I completely agree with you.
Let's move on to another subject that came up, and it's also national. That's the president's attempt to ban transgender servicemen and women from the armed forces. It may become a moot point simply because it hasn't happened and the Pentagon hasn't let it happen. But if it did, I mean, it seems to me like this is a discrimination suit big time waiting to happen.
I think the more interesting aspect, though, is the disarray in the executive branch that Trump issues these tweets. Apparently, it took Defense Secretary Mattis, who was on vacation at the time, by surprise. The Joint Chiefs of Staff have issued a public rebuke. So it shows real disarray and lack of communication, I think. And I wonder whether it was just a distraction at a time of high drama in the healthcare debate.
Well, we don't need to get into this, but the 9-minute gap between the two tweets was in and of itself problematical, I think, in many ways.
Right. You know, there is a Missouri connection to this transgender ban, because apparently Representative Vicky Hartzler helped bring the issue to the White House's attention after a proposed amendment to a defense bill was rejected by the House that would have banned spending federal dollars on transgender medical care.
Right. And, I mean, first she tried to ban transgender soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And then she backed off and said just ban the medical care. And then she lost on that in the Republican House. And I think it's really interesting that there's been a lot of Republicans reacted to the Trump tweet in a very negative way. You know, Joni Ernst from Iowa, Orrin Hatch, and others. And, the whole idea that the tweet seemed to say you cannot have any transgender soldiers would not be permitted to remain in the military. And even though the courts give very broad latitude to the military to define a particular group of people and say these people cannot be included in the U.S. military, I think it's really big constitutional questions. I don't think you can do it. And the fact that the Department of Defense itself, right, after the president's tweet, went ahead and said we're not changing anything right now
because of a tweet, and it's also a very different reaction than you had to Bill Clinton when he said we're going to let gays in the military, and and Colin Powell says we're not ready for that. In 30 years, we've come full circle where now the military is saying, this is not such a good idea. We need to protect our transgender
members. And in terms of public opinion, polls now show that a majority, I think 57% of Americans surveyed, support the inclusion of transgender soldiers.
And these Republicans that were fighting Trump on it, I mean, they're not on the edge Republicans. These are hardcore conservative Republicans.
It'll be interesting to see if the president follows up. We shall see. Have to take a break. We'll do that now. We're continuing our discussion momentarily with Susan Appleton, Bill Freivogel, and Mark Smith, the members of our Legal Roundtable panel today. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. With me in studio, Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor at Washington University, Susan Appleton, Washington University Law School Professor, and Bill Freivogel, Professor of Journalism at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, all attorneys. Let me throw this one at you, lady and gentlemen. The U.S. Appeals Court says the suit against Ferguson and Darren Wilson, the officer who shot Michael Brown, may go forward. It was filed by Dorian Johnson, who was with Michael Brown when he was shot. Johnson claims his rights were violated because police were not trained properly. Does that seem like a bit of a stretch to anybody?
Not under the standard that the court had to use in considering whether or not to throw out the complaint, because at that procedural point, the court has to take as true the allegations in the complaint. And so based on what Dorian Johnson has alleged, the Court of Appeals found that the suit could go forward with respect to Darren Wilson as one defendant and the chief of police of Ferguson as another. It said it wasn't ready to review the claim of municipal liability against Ferguson.
So this was a motion to dismiss. So a motion to dismiss says, even if everything they say is true, let's give them the benefit of the doubt on everything. As a matter of law, there's not enough here. The court doesn't recognize an injury. So as Susan said, you got to give every benefit to the plaintiff here and say, let's assume everything he says is true and that the officer pulled his car in front and there's an issue of whether or not there was a seizure, whether they were detained. And the court's basically saying, let's assume that happened. And is that enough? Yeah, okay. We'll let it go to trial, and then we'll find out what the real facts are.
And so there, Dorian Johnson will have to prove his allegations, and the court will have to find those facts and see whether or not the facts—
Doesn't mean he's won. It means he gets his day in court.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
And among the facts that the court was assuming to be true was Johnson's description of what happened, which includes that— Michael Brown did not resist in any way, didn't try to get the gun, was just running away. All things that are contradicted by all the federal and state investigations.
Okay. Also, relative to the situation in Ferguson, the Missouri Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, has just now implemented rulings made in 2016 with regard to setting minimum requirements for municipal courts.
I was really surprised at this because this has been going on for a long time. Just now implemented. Why did it take so long?
Well, I think they just – I think there was just a time period during which they were being put into effect. I think there actually has been – I mean, I wrote a story a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, saying how weak the Supreme Court had been and the St. Louis County Circuit Court had been in following up on Ferguson. And then, you know, like in the fall – might have been October or November, the Supreme Court came down with these minimum standards, which are now in effect. And St. Louis County now has a judge overseeing the municipal division, Judge Beach, and you know, people like Thomas Harvey, who are very strong advocates right. for people, are saying Judge Beach is doing a great job of making sure that the municipal courts are following the requirements. And there have been some – all these requirements and other pressures have caused there to be quite a bit of consolidation among some of the smaller municipal courts. I mean, the problem is far from solved, but right. there has been – you know, at this point, at least there has been some real progress, I think.
And Harvey's not satisfied, just to be clear, right? But there seems to be some progress being made.
And
we
in
just
fact,
have too
I
many
think
small
regular
courts.
Progress reports are part of the right. requirement.
And apparently, they're doing spot checks unannounced. So that all sounds like good stuff.
The returning to the city now, our Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner is going to court, so she can go to court. This is confusing me a little bit. She's asking the Missouri Supreme Court to overturn a decision disqualifying her office from prosecuting a murder case that she talked about during her campaign. What is that all about?
Do you yes. know? So there's this guy, Tyrell Davidson, who was indicted for murder. And represented by the Public Defender's Office, Gardner's first assistant, Robert Steele, came from the Public Defender's Office. So there's an argument now because you can't have a lawyer on both sides. Now, having said that, in civil cases, you would oftentimes, with huge law firms, lawyers moving back and forth, or representing different parties, you would sometimes see, they used to call them Chinese walls put up. I don't think that's politically appropriate. Yeah, this was a long time ago. But so it would say, so maybe I'm the lawyer who worked at the other firm. Susan and Bill are trying the case. It would say all these files can only be seen by Susan and Bill. I specifically can't see them. Now, in a criminal case, you want more of a division, so that may not be possible. And I'm not sure what the ethic rules are for prosecutors versus just regular lawyers. But it would seem to me that they could set up a way where this first assistant would just not be a party to any of it. And, mm-hmm. you know, everyone says we're not going to talk to him.
Yeah, the concern is his first assistant, Robert Steele, had access when he was in the public defender's office, had access to the public defender's mm-hmm. file in this case, and now he's on the prosecution
but
side.
But access in theory, right? There's no evidence
in
that
theory.
He looked at it or anything, right?
Right. And apparently this is a big deal to Kim Gardner's office because she campaigned on
exactly.
This was one of the cases she raised in her campaign.
Because I think in this case, there were threats made to witnesses. Mm. So this is a pretty nasty case.
Yeah. And, you know, and this is something on which she and Jennifer Joyce, her predecessor, really agreed that this
right.
is a huge problem of threats to witnesses in cases and the difficulty in getting eyewitnesses to cooperate in a lot of the big prosecutions.
Why are we talking about Kim Gardner? She's lost about a third of the staff since she's been in office just half a year now. What do you make of that? I mean, this has got to be a serious hobbling effect, have a serious hobbling effect on conducting business in the circuit attorney's office.
Yeah, well, I think we talked about this last month, and I think
but more have left since.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bad sign, and I know that I don't want to say that Kim Gardner has failed because I know that the people who elected her have such high hopes for her. You know, it was this new young group of voters in the city of St. Louis who sort of were an outgrowth of the whole Ferguson protest, and who were big supporters of hers and have high hopes for her, you know, for her changing the sort of focus of the circuit attorney's office. But I do think that some of the initial problems with losing staff and all are a bad sign. But I think she still has time to pull out of it.
Yeah, and I'm less concerned than Bill. And just because you had Jennifer Joyce in that office for, what, 12, 16 years? I mean, it was a long time. So some of these people have been with Jennifer for a long time. Think about it in your own job. People leave when they get a new boss. I mean, those are the critical times because the new boss comes in and does different things or maybe doesn't. You get moved and people tend to leave at those times. Plus, circuit attorneys move a lot. Public defenders and circuit attorneys, they can make a lot more money in the private sector. They've got a real set of skills that are sought after. And so, I mean, I'm a little concerned, but I'm not overly concerned with it.
Susan,
and she can hire new people for the office as well, so it could present an opportunity.
Yeah, of course, they don't pay very much,
no.
And that's
no.
Hiring isn't it's itself a problem. Okay, but while we're just talking about that, a lot of publicity over the last couple of weeks with regard to problems in the city jail during the heat. Are there any potential lawsuits here, do you think, prisoners? Have any kind of case to make for the treatment in the workhouse?
Well, yeah, I would think that you can make an Eighth Amendment claim of cruel and unusual punishment. I believe I read that Thomas Harvey and his Arch City Defenders had come up with money to bail some of the folks out to get them out of the workhouse. I mean, that workhouse has been there since I started as a reporter 40-plus years ago.
And has it ever not had a period where there haven't been problems? I mean, remember we had the gladiator fights in the jail where they were allegedly pitting inmates against inmates? I think that was like 5 years ago. There were overcrowding. I mean, it's constantly, and it always seems like there's something that brings it to a head and everyone gets worked up and then it kind of fades away again.
I just wanted to provide a shout out for a story that St. Louis Public Radio has posted about the workhouse, where I learned much more than I ever knew before about the workhouse. It's called What's the Workhouse? What You Need to Know About St. Louis's Medium Security Institution, and it was very informative.
Yeah. Also connecting all of this with the Kim Gardner situation, mm-hmm. If she has a much smaller staff, that means they're not going to be able to prosecute as many cases, which means a lot of these people in the workhouse are going to be there for a lot longer than they might otherwise have been.
Because these are people who've been charged, not convicted, who are in the workhouse.
Right. So it's another aspect to this loss of staff at Kim Gardner's office. All righty, where are we going to go from here? I want to bring in the fact that we have a new Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court. That would be Zell Fisher, a former justice. He replaces Patricia Breckenridge. What do we know about him? Does this really mean anything significant to the man on the street?
Well, I haven't met him, but he's a country lawyer.
And woman on the street, I might add. Yes, Susan.
A country lawyer, a country judge. He was elected. He was one of the elected judges. You know, in the rural areas, they elect their state judges. He was elected an associate circuit judge in his northwest Missouri county. He was appointed to the Missouri Supreme Court by Matt Blunt. And who, of course, was a Republican governor. From the Missouri Supreme Court decisions which I have read, I have not found him to be, a conservative ideologue in any way. He seems to be oftentimes with the majority on the court, and we should point out that the Supreme Court position on the Missouri Supreme Court is a rotating. It just rotates every 2 years.
Right. And Breckenridge continues to serve on the court. She's just no longer the Chief Justice.
That is a finite term. In other words, the Chief Justice serves for
2 years.
2 years, period. And then
it goes in order of seniority, I believe.
Okay.
Whereas U.S. Supreme Court, your Chief Justice, as long as you can hold on.
Hold on to it, right.
So we've heard. So we've heard. One other issue here to bring to the fore, and that's the, again, I think a lot of people might be confused by this, and that's the right to work issue, which many people thought was resolved by the Missouri legislature. But that's not the case, and the courts have come into play with regard to right to work. Organized labor is certainly putting up a fight to overturn what has been passed by the legislature. What's going on there? Anyone have a feeling about it?
So there was a Court of Appeals decision that went in favor of labor. So you need to know there are two proposals that the labor unions have suggested. One is a referendum. That's what the Court of Appeals decision was about. The referendum would have the if they get enough signatures by the end of August, would allow voters in November 2018 to decide get rid of the right to work law that the Missouri legislature passed this past term. And
that would also delay implementation of the right to work law.
So it would not go into effect until
that effect on August 28th.
Right.
Right.
The Court of Appeals was reversing the lower court, and a lot of the reason they basically said that the referendum language was written in an acceptable manner. There were some grammatical mistakes in it. They said, big deal. There were some language like a fair deduction from your wages that the challengers thought was, you know, sort of slanted it in labor's to their favor. And the court said, you know, but there's also countervailing language. And then the other issue that they dealt with was it's possible that both the referendum and the other labor union supported idea of an initiative to change the Missouri Constitution could both end up on the same ballot. And so, you know, would that be too confusing? And this Missouri Supreme Court said no. I mean, the court said it would not be too confusing. So the initiative is something that I guess the labor unions have sort of as a backup. In case they don't get enough votes for the referendum, they would have more months to collect enough signatures for the initiative to change the Missouri Constitution to say you can't ever pass a right-to-work law or anything that's sort of abrogating deals between corporations and labor unions.
People don't want it to be confusing, but it is confusing.
It is confusing, yes.
In the minute and a half we have left, we have an email from Madonna here. Interesting point raises. Let's get it done in a minute 30. Why is the officialness of the president's tweets important from a legal point of view? Is a tweet an official presidential decree? Or
I don't think it is.
Executive order or whatever you want to call it?
It's like talking. And I would think if you're going to say to the military, we're not going to allow transgender folks into the military, we would probably need more than just a tweet or him to say it off. That's my position.
Well, I mean, it's a hard question. And I thought, but I'm just relying on my memory here. It's not something I checked out. I believe that the White House press office said that his tweets should be considered to be official statements. I guess Mark is getting to the legal importance of, you know, can we basically hold the president to the things that he tweets? And I would think that we could.
I know this a conversation about this has been going on in the media, and whether tweets are getting too much attention, should we take them seriously, should we believe them, how binding are they, and I don't know that it's been completely worked out, though apparently the new direction forward for the Trump administration is to let Trump be Trump, and I think that means we see more tweets.
Never a dull moment, that's for sure.
If I were General Kelly, I would say something about
that.
We'll
see how that turns out. Folks, thanks very much. Our time is up. We've been talking with Mark Smith, Bill Feivogel, and Susan Appleton, our legal roundtable panel today. Thank you all so much for being with us. Great to see you.
Thank you.
Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/STL on air. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.